Welcome to the Capital News. I am your host, Alex Caritas. Today is February 19th, 2020. Thank you so much for joining. My apologies for not giving off a podcast yesterday. I had some other technical difficulties, unfortunately, but here we are back in it again today. So it's going to be a little bit of a mashup between what I wanted to discuss yesterday, which of course was continued into today. And then I also want to talk about some politics because we had the Democrats debate this evening in Nevada, ahead of the Nevada caucus coming up here shortly. And former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, took to the stage for the first time. So we're going to talk about that, some of the implications of his performance, the fact that the field is going to start really, really narrowing down here, probably only going to have three, maybe four candidates remaining after the next couple of weeks. So it's really getting down to crunch time. So a lot of the knives and daggers were out in today's throwdown in Las Vegas. So we'll talk about that. But first to the market performance, because we were speaking the other day on the previous podcast of the title, Which Way Is Up? Was really talking about what's going on here with all of the negative guidance, the negative forward guidance that we are starting to hear from companies. Prime and center was Apple. When they came out and said, yes, we're going to suffer an impact, a direct hit, because of the coronavirus that is taking place in China, both from a supply shock and a demand shock, because clearly the supply chains are hit because half of China is in quarantine. That hits the supply chain. Well, guess what it also hits? If you're not producing, these people aren't making money, so they're also not consuming. And if they're in quarantine, if they have to stay in their homes, well, then they're not going out and buying anything. So it's a double whammy. So if anybody on the financial media is saying it's only one or the other, that it's a demand shock or that it's a supply shock, it's both. It's both. It's not just one or the other. This is going to have material effects that is going to come through at least through the first quarter numbers of 2020. I imagine that this is going to continue probably into the second quarter as well. And that assumes that everything is contained and that the coronavirus does not spread further. However, we are unfortunately already seeing signs that that does not appear to be the case. We are seeing an increase in cases in Japan and an increase of cases in South Korea as well. We have the one in Egypt that was confirmed, and I have some early reports that there is a confirmed case coming out of Iran as well. So this thing is far from contained. And if it has the incubation period that it does, and if people can walk around without having symptoms, but are still nevertheless contagious, that's cause for concern. That's why you have epidemiologists out of Harvard saying that this could possibly affect 40 to 70% of the world's population, not just of China, but 40 to 70% of the world's population. And again, folks, it's not just the mortality rate that we have to be concerned with. Of course, that's bad, but it's the severe cases that need, you know, intensive care unit type of support in a hospital that can overwhelm healthcare systems around the world, especially in underdeveloped countries, where these countries, especially emerging markets, were already getting battered because of lower prices for commodities and because of the double whammy that they're dealing with the amount of debt that is coming due. And a lot of that debt is U.S. dollar denominated. And when you have all of these things taking place, it's just sort of this perfect storm for some sort of massive cleansing that is likely to ensue over global markets. And then add on top of it, you have the coronavirus, which, again, could be one of the catalysts to kickstart this type of debt liquidation and all of this real price discovery that we have yet to see in these markets for months. And at the time of this podcast, there is no end in sight. We've spoken on this a lot last year, that there was a possibility of a melt-up. I mean, I guess the definition of a melt-up is part of it anyway, is that it can go on for a lot longer than anybody anticipates. And that, again, is what we are appearing to see. This thing just continues to go higher and higher and higher. It doesn't matter that Apple came out and said, yep, we're going to take a big hit. We're not going to hit our first quarter numbers. Not going to happen. What's the market do? Shrugs it off. We don't care. Apple stock goes up. Same thing took place with the apparel companies Puma and Adidas. They both came out and said the same thing. Negative guidance. We are not going to hit our numbers. We are going to have material effects because of what's taking place in China right now. Who cares? Puma went up, I think, at the highest point. It went up 8%. It went up 8% on negative guidance. We're not going to make revenue. We're not going to make profits. 8% up. This does not make any sense whatsoever. And Adidas went up too, not to such a degree, but this is not how markets are supposed to function. This is because we have all of these crackheads, not just on Wall Street, but in markets all over the world right now, thinking that somehow money printing is this magical panacea that's just going to solve all of our ills. Well, a logical and reasonable question to ask oneself in this regard is, if that's all it ever took, money printing, to cure all of our ills, whether they're monetary policies, whether they're fiscal policies, whether they're economic, financial, whether it's a disease, doesn't matter. Why did it take us, the human race, so long to figure this out? Because central banking is not a new invention. It's been around for centuries. It's been around for centuries, okay? So this is not a new invention. Oh, we just found out that it has this mystical power, that it can solve all of the world's problems. That's not how it works. If it was that potent, if it was that effective, then Zimbabwe would be one of the wealthiest countries in the world. The Weimar Republic in Germany, after World War I, wouldn't have had any problems. Wouldn't have had any problems. They would have been completely successful. Venezuela wouldn't have any problems. Argentina wouldn't be on the brink of bankruptcy once again if it was just, well, we're just going to print money, take on more debt, and have no problems. That's not how it works. The risk-reward at this juncture is it's terrifying. Now, you can still make a lot of money, potentially, if continuing to ride this thing up, and who knows when it's going to burst. But I can assure you, ladies and gentlemen, that one day it will. All I ever say to this audience is stay diversified and stay vigilant, because that's the best we can do. Have a little bit of everything, because we don't know what is going to creep up out of the woodwork, because it could be inflation. And then what are central banks going to do? Because they've been allegedly trying to create inflation for years, and they keep telling us that it doesn't exist. Yet everybody knows that it exists. They know what your, you know what your health care bill is. You know what you're paying on your premiums every year. That they go up 5% or they go up 20%. You know what you're paying at the grocery store. You know about your utility bill. You know about your car payment and the cost of your car. And get this. I mean, we talk about this all the time, too, with the rising delinquency rates in the automobile sector, which is at an all-time high, surpassing what was witnessed a decade ago. But of course, this is the greatest economy ever. Don't forget that. But there are reports out of the Wall Street Journal where there are actual dealerships, recommending to potential buyers, oh, you have a car? Don't make any more payments on it. Don't do it. Don't make your payments. Just let the lender, whoever owns the loan, let them take possession of it, and then we'll give you another car. Does that sound right? Does that sound like the greatest economy ever? Does that sound like free market capitalism to you, ladies and gentlemen? This is real, by the way. This is like the subprime crisis all over again, because people are getting desperate. The automobile sector has produced too many cars because of the effects of monetary policy and fiscal policy. It sends poor signals out to the market. There has been overproduction. Now, typically, I wouldn't use these types of words, overproduction, but now we know that that is the case. Typically, the best word to use for these types of things, overproduction, underproduction, whatever the case might be, is malinvestment. That's the best way to summarize it. But now we know that this has been a result, and it's created overcapacity, overproduction. And now prices would typically come down in this type of environment for these vehicles, or any good for that matter. If you can't sell a good at $30,000, well, then one would think, well, if I'm going to sell it, I can't make it $35,000. Oh, yeah, everybody's going to come in to spend an extra $5,000 that they don't have. That's not how it works. Well, if it's not selling at $30,000, well, then they're going to have to drop it $29,000, $28,000, $25,000 until they get buyers. You understand? This is simple economics. But now, that's not what happens in this economy anymore. We have idiots at dealerships telling people to default on their loan so you can get into a new car because there's oversupply, there's overproduction of these vehicles. Not to mention the declining sale rate of automobiles the world over. But nevertheless, we still have Tesla taking off. I think it's back over $900 a share, making it one of the largest automobile companies in the world. I think it's only second to Toyota. Toyota sells millions of vehicles per year. Tesla sells a few hundred thousand. This makes no sense whatsoever. This would not be able to happen if there was not the amount of liquidity that was being thrown into these markets. And where is any leadership from the Democratic Party calling this out? Where is any leadership from the Republicans saying, this ain't free market capitalism, this isn't aren't these the conservative American beliefs that we stand by and we talk about for generations? No, there is nothing. And then you have the biggest cheerleader in the White House egging this whole chaotic thing on. Negative interest rates, give me that money, I want that money. It was a bubble under Obama, going to cause a catastrophe. Now he's president, give it to me. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. It's just one hit after the next. And you know who's going to end up paying for this at the end of the day, don't you? It's going to be you and me. It's going to be the average Joe. It's not going to be Donald Trump and Ivanka and Donnie Jr. It's not going to be them. It's not going to be Michael Bloomberg. You know, and I don't like getting into class warfare, but when you do these types of actions, this is what happens. It's because there's only a handful of billionaires. There's not enough money to pay the bill. So, well, you got to be bailed out. You got to go to the masses. Well, that's the average Jane and Joe out there. We're going to have to flip this bill once again. After a decade ago, when we had a bailout Wall Street, and here they are up to their, you know, their same antics once again. And it's going to be even more devastating this time, because before it was really more hyper-focused in one sector of the economy with housing. And of course, there were a lot of secondary and tertiary markets that sprung up around it, and there's always going to be ripple effects and the interconnectedness of everything, which we talk about here all the time. But now, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. It's in commercial real estate. It's in some residential real estate, once again, depending on, you know, the cities. It's always location, location, location. Again, it's going to be a top-down, bottom-up destruction when it comes to housing this time around. Believe me when I tell you, it's in the auto sector. You now have an extra $1 trillion in student loan debt. I mean, the hits just keep on coming. It's a stock market that is beyond belief. I mean, you even have Jim Cramer. I seen a tweet from Jim Cramer that was retweeted by somebody I follow. What's going on here? What's going on? Where are the sellers? Where have the sellers gone? Jim Cramer. Mr. Buy, buy, buy. Mr. Everything goes up all the time. Buy, buy, buy. What's going on here? This is how crazy it is when you get these type of people that come out and they're like, what's going on? Where are the sellers? How can this market continue to go up? Because it's defying all logic. And if markets defy all logic, what are we supposed to base our decisions off of? How are you supposed to make a rational decision if rationality is thrown to the wind? How are we supposed to, and this goes to anything, this is a financial decision, an investment decision, a business decision, if you're an entrepreneur, as a citizen, what's the truth? How are we supposed to be dutiful citizens and vote for our elected officials if we don't have the full truth? If we can't operate from a foundation of rationality and truth, we're screwed. Now, I think we're probably beyond that point, because of what's been taking place in this country for years. And now it's just this culmination of everything coming together. And now we have Donald Trump in the White House. And again, bragging and calling for these types of policies is as disastrous as it gets. And this audience should understand the negative consequences and effects of negative interest rates. You know, another interesting little statistic that I came across here recently as well, and this has only been in the second time, I think, in all of U.S. history, or at least modern history, and that going back to like the 1960s, 1950s, is the entire yield curve, the Treasury curve, from 1 month T-bills all the way out to the 30-year Treasury bond. It is all yielding lower, a lower yield than the rate of inflation. You are guaranteed to lose money because of the effects of inflation and because of the effects of taxation. It's a double whammy. And inflation is a hidden tax, as this audience knows. It's just you don't vote for it. It just comes to you because politicians can't keep their promises. They can't balance the checkbook. So we got $1 trillion deficits. So you're guaranteed to lose money, yet we still have a positive nominal yielding Treasury curve. Okay, but in real terms, when you take that nominal yield, subtract out the inflation rate, we have real negative interest rates. So they're basically in effect already here. It's just a question of when is Donald Trump finally going to get his wish with the Federal Reserve saying, yeah, you know what, 1.25% to 1.5% just ain't cutting it, folks. We got to go to negative territory. And I asked the question once again, if you think it's so great, why don't you go ask the people in Japan how that's working out for them? You remember their fourth quarter GDP number that just came out? They contracted by 6%. You want that? Why don't you go ask the people of Europe how negative interest rates are working for them in their financial sector? Their banking sector hasn't recovered in a decade. And now you have Germany, the largest economy in the European Union, in Europe, one of the largest economies in the world for that matter, basically in recession. So you have two of the largest economies in Japan and in Germany on the brink of recession. And I would make the claim that they already are in recession because those are the fourth quarter numbers that we have witnessed. That doesn't even take into consideration coronavirus and what's been taking place on the demand side and the supply shock as a result of the coronavirus and a whole host of other policies that are disastrous the world over. Again, the coronavirus is an exacerbation. That's all it is. It's going to exacerbate these other underlying financial and economic issues. Now, if it turns out to be something much larger, then it's going to be a bigger problem. The economics and the finance of it is going to be secondary, or at least I hope it is. But right now, it is not secondary. Economics and finance and the stock market, that's all it's about. That's all it's about. People are dying, yeah, but the rate of it's going down, so who really cares? They'll get back and they'll start buying things again. It'll be a V-shaped recovery. As soon as these people are out of quarantine, they're going to rush to go buy an iPhone because that's exactly what I would do as soon as I got out of a quarantine, wouldn't you? I mean, the first thing is what evidently is how these markets are rationalizing things. And who knows? Maybe they'll be right. Maybe a whole bunch of idiots in China are going to say, yeah, you know, I've been quarantined here for a month and a half. The first thing I want to do is go buy a new iPhone, put on a pair of Puma shoes, and buy a Adidas jacket, and I'm going to be stunning. And that's it. I don't think that's likely to happen, but maybe I'm wrong. But regardless, those share prices are going to the moon. This is ridiculous. Ridiculous. And what do we have taking place this evening? We have China cutting their benchmark lending rate. Oh, what a surprise. What a surprise that they're going to have to, quote-unquote, stimulate the economy once again. The People's Bank of China lowered its benchmark one-year loan prime rate, the LPR, by 10 basis points to 4.05%. Amid efforts to support the economy battling with the virus outbreak, the one-year LPR, again, loan prime rate, now has been cut four times since it became the official key rate in August of 2019. So four rate cuts since August of last month. That's basically one rate cut every month and a half. Fantastic. The five-year LPR was slashed by 5 basis points to 4.75%. The rate adjustment came days after the People's Bank of China cut the rate for medium-term loans. They just keep cutting them. They just keep cutting them because they think money printing, cutting interest rates, throwing liquidity into these markets is just going to save the day. It's going to be a global panacea. I don't think so, folks. But buckle up and get used to the ride because this is ridiculous. Now, we also have, because of Japan contracting by 6% in the fourth quarter of last year, guess who's probably on, just ready to push that button, pull that trigger to cut interest rates again or to flood the markets with more liquidity? You guessed it, the Bank of Japan. They're getting ready to cut rates, make no mistake about it. They're probably just going to start buying everything again, all of the Japanese stocks and ETFs and all that. And don't forget that the Swiss National Bank purchases U.S. shares outright. Remember, we talked about this. They have a printing press, they can print money at will, and then they can go out and they can buy equities. Well, how could they possibly lose? If you could do that, good luck. But once they catch you, they're going to lock you up and throw away the key. We also have numbers coming out of Australia. The Australian jobless rate rises to a three-month high. We have now unemployment rate at 5.3%, which is higher than the consensus at 5.2%. So if you remember our discussion on the Reserve Bank of Australia and the meeting minutes that they have been discussing for quite a while in the Reserve Bank of Australia, one of the key indicators that they are going to be monitoring in their assessment as to whether or not to lower interest rates, keep them on hold, hike them, of course, that's a joke, nobody's going to increase their interest rates, is the jobless claims, is the numbers, the unemployment number, excuse me. So the fact that this is ticked up to 5.3% above consensus, is now going to put more pressure on Australia to cut interest rates once again. Now, this is no surprise, especially when you have the coronavirus taking place primarily in Asia. Okay, this is now you got to pay attention to the geography of everything. You got to understand the geopolitics of it. You have to understand the trading partners and the trading magnitude, the relationship between Australia and much of Asia, sending all of their iron ore, their gold, all of the other natural materials that they have that they ship up to Asia. And now if you have Japan contracting to the degree in which it is, you're going to have China contracting big time. You're going to have South Korea continue to slow down. And this is all across the board. Singapore, Vietnam, Thailand. So many of these countries have already come out and also given forward negative guidance that GDP is going to be lower than what was originally estimated at the end of last year or in early January of this year. Why? Because of the effects surrounding the coronavirus. Now, that's going to, again, exacerbate it. Their numbers were wrong to begin with. We talk about this all the time. Why? Because nobody is truly focused on the numbers. They just want to pay attention to the headlines. You got to look under the hood and pay attention and dissect them. And that's what we do here on a daily basis. I gave you the list all the time. Go look them up. I'll give them to you again. Construction, retail, manufacturing, industrial production, transports, federal, state, and local tax receipts, corporate profits, and jobless claims. Go look them all up and tell me this is the greatest economy ever. Not even close. Not even close. And we have the Cass Freight Index. I'm not going to have enough time to get to that today, but the Cass Freight Index came out with their January report. And guess what, folks? We're looking at numbers that we have not seen since guess when? Oh, that's right. The financial crisis. Can't make this stuff up. Yet somehow we have a president of the United States who comes out and tells us on a near daily basis that this is the greatest economy ever. And what two statistics does he look at? An unemployment rate and the stock market. A stock market that is completely detached and decoupled from the underlying economics and is only rallying to the degree in which it is because of Federal Reserve and other monetary policy around the world. That's it. Not because of a booming economy here in the United States, not because of a booming economy in Europe or in China or in Japan or in South America or in Africa. You know why? Because it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. This is all a con job. And you better wake up and you better start paying attention. And guess what? There aren't any politicians talking about it. You got the idiots on the left saying, well, it's wealth inequality, but why aren't you talking about the Federal Reserve, Bernie, or Elizabeth, or anybody else for that matter? And why is Donald Trump, why did he flip the switch? He was going after them. Now he wants it. Are you okay with this? I'm not. I'd like to know why you are, if you are. What is your justification? What's your rationale? Because this is not going to end well. Believe me when I tell you. What else do we have here? Oh, yeah, I do want to talk some of the numbers, I guess. Let's see. We have on the stock front, we have the Dow Jones Industrial Average gaining 116 points, up 0.4%. We have the S&P 500 closing at a record high, gaining 22 points, up almost 0.7%, closing at 3,386 points. So it's just a few points away from 3,400. And ladies and gentlemen, 3,400 was the target, was the year-end target for the S&P 500. We're about to hit it, and we're only a month, 2 months into the year. 3,400. We are basically a day away from this happening. We have the NASDAQ 100 gaining 89 points, up 0.92%, closing at 9,719 points, close to 10,000. We could be there by the end of this week, the way this thing continues to move. And because there's more stimulus taking place, because China cut the interest rate, we have now the Japanese markets trading at the time of this podcast up 327 points, an increase of 1.4%. Throughout the trading day, Europe is pretty much in the green, up, you know, anywhere from 0.8% all the way up to 1% in the UK exchange. And we have the Shanghai, the Chinese markets also gaining 32 points, up 1% for the day. On the commodity front, we continue to have oil inching higher. We have WTI trading at $53.53 a barrel. Brent, the international metric, is at $59.40. Natural gas continues its climb, getting closer to $2. It is now trading at $1.96. per million British thermal units. Gold and silver have been on a nice little up rally, but are giving back slightly. We now have gold trading at $1,612 an ounce, breaching that $1,600 an ounce threshold. It is going to be critical to see if gold can maintain that critical number and continue to the upside, or at least make $1,600 a firm point of resistance. Silver has gained quite significantly over the past couple of days and is now trading at $18.40 an ounce. So another question for silver, as is with gold, will $18 prove to be a strong point of resistance, or is this just going to be short-lived because of a safe haven play, if you will, because of all of the increased risk? You basically, folks, have an increase across the board. Commodities are now inching up. You have precious metals that are going up. You have bond prices that continue to go up. And you have the stock market that continues to go up. This could be what the Austrian economists claim could be a crack-up boom. Okay? What follows a crack-up boom is a disaster. All right? So it really doesn't matter what you're holding. You better hold, you know, beans and butter and guns and ammo, because money ain't going to do you any good. You better have survival skills. And I'm not being hyperbolic here, but this is ludicrous. I mean, when you watch some of the financial media and you have some very level-headed people who have been in the industry for years coming out saying, I've never seen this in my lifetime. And these are people who have lived through 1980s, or 1970s even. They've seen the inflation of the 1970s. They saw the 1987 stock market crash. They saw the 2000 episode. They saw the savings and loan crisis. They saw the Asian currency crisis. They saw the great financial crisis. And now they're saying, this is ridiculous. I've never seen anything like this. So something's up here, folks. Something is greatly amiss. All right? And it is across the spectrum. All of these assets cannot be right, because they are all sending different signals. Is it going to be inflationary? Is it going to be deflationary? Is it going to be growth? Is it going to be no growth? Because the stock market would have you believe that there is going to be terrific growth ahead, okay, in the near term, because the stock market only looks out so far. It's not like the stock market's looking out 5 years, 10 years. It's looking out maybe 6 months. It's not that far ahead looking, okay? Because people aren't that far ahead looking. It's quarter to quarter, if you're lucky. All right. Bonds, on the other hand, are saying there's not going to be any growth. There's not going to be any growth. We got the 10-year back under 1.6%, yielding 1.56. There's no growth. The 30-year treasury bond is down at 2%, almost hitting record lows once again. There's no growth. That's a generation, basically 30 years of no growth. So something's amiss. This all cannot be correct. Who's going to win out at the end of the day? That's why you have to have a little bit of everything, because who knows what's going to take off? Who knows where this money, this cheap liquidity, this crack cocaine is going to find itself in this economy? But that's all it is. It's just monetary methadone. It's just crack cocaine for these addicts. But guess what? This is the system in which we live. So if you want to benefit from it, you better get involved to some degree. To some degree. Paying attention, being diversified, and staying vigilant. So that's the markets. It's ludicrous, negative guidance, coronavirus, anything else, doesn't matter. Locusts, fires, earthquakes, doesn't matter. Keep going up. Now on to the Democratic debate this evening in Las Vegas ahead of the Nevada caucus. Mayor of New York City, or former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, took to the stage. His performance was not that good. It was not that good at all. Everybody had their daggers out at the ready for him. I'm sure there was some sort of, coordination amongst the candidates, because they all seemed to pick on something different about him. Who got the knockout blow was probably Senator Elizabeth Warren, because she went after him on his quote-unquote sexism and what took place within his companies and non-disclosure agreements, yada, yada, yada. And unfortunately for Michael Bloomberg, he was seemingly caught off guard or flat-footed or didn't know how to defend himself. Or perhaps that was his strategy. Just, you know what, I'm not going to get involved with this. But he should have had an answer, because politics is about being on the offense, not on the defense. And that is one of the reasons why Donald Trump was able to get himself to where he is at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, because he was shameless. I'm not saying that's a good thing, because it's not, especially in regards to a lot of the things that has taken place, but that's whatever. But he was always fighting. He was always on the attack. He was always on the offensive. Bloomberg got caught off guard, or which he shouldn't have been. He shouldn't have been caught off guard. He's paying a lot of people a lot of money to, I would imagine, prepare him and to give him analysis as to what's likely taking place. There was also reports that he was preparing for this debate, doing mock debates. I mean, did nobody on his team play the bad guy and come at him full bore? Because in a couple weeks, folks, the Democrats are really going to have this thing narrowed down to two or three candidates. So everybody, all the bombs, all of the big punches had to come out tonight. And most of them were lobbed at Michael Bloomberg. You know, they tried throwing some punches at Senator Bernie Sanders, but Bernie Sanders is Bernie Sanders. He's going to say what he's going to say. He doesn't care what you say about him. He's going to answer his own question. He's going to continue to focus on what he wants to talk about. He's going to focus and pivot on the issues. He's very good at that. Nobody really went after Joe Biden. So I don't know if that's a calculation amongst the candidates that Uncle Joe's pretty much done. He's going to be taking a nap and retiring to Delaware in short order. But most of the lobs and attacks were thrown at Michael Bloomberg. And again, Elizabeth Warren got the most effective one because Bloomberg was, again, seemingly caught off guard and flat-footed and didn't have a response to the non-disclosure agreements in regards to what Bloomberg allegedly did to some women. We don't know how many women. We don't know what the true allegations were. So there are some outstanding questions in that regard. Bloomberg, I think, should have taken that more from the standpoint of, you know what, this is just another distraction. We got a guy in the White House we got to get rid of. That should have been his argument, something along those lines. I want to tackle XYZ issues, and here's how I'm going to do it. This petty politics, this is exactly what Donald Trump wants. He wants the theater, because Donald Trump loves putting on a show. He loves the chaos. He loves the drama, and you fell right for his trap. And we have to be bigger than that, and we have to rise above that. Those things, those have been handled. That's done. I'm here to become the president of the United States, and I'm going to tackle A, B, C, X, Y, Z, 1, 2, 3. That should have been his answer, but it wasn't. He was silent. So it's either something that's maybe really serious in some of those non-disclosure agreements, or he just really didn't want to be there. But, you know, politics is a public sport, and I understand that Michael Bloomberg, this is not his forte. He does not like these debates. He has not debated since he was mayor about 10 years ago, and then here he is coming onto the big stage, gaining in the pool, spending a whole bunch of money, and he's in the arena, and he has not been there for a long time. So the question is, how many people watch this debate? How much news coverage is there going to be of this debate in regards to what Elizabeth Warren did to Michael Bloomberg? Because who knows who could interfere and change the whole news cycle? Because if Donald Trump can't keep himself away from this, then he's going to end up sucking up all the oxygen. When in fact, well, you know, if he would have stayed away, maybe this really could have deterred people from going to Michael Bloomberg. Maybe Donald Trump doesn't care. But that's going to be interesting to see how the news cycle follows this. Because Elizabeth Warren, you know, however long it's been in the campaign season already, I guess is finally figured out, and it's too little too late, that she was not going to beat Bernie Sanders, that she was not going to take his lane and his voters from him. I mean, we've been saying this from day one. I mean, Pocahontas doesn't have it together, folks. Now, all of a sudden, she's dodging. She's trying to get the billionaire out of the race. And now she's trying to get votes from maybe Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar or Joe Biden. Too little, too late, Elizabeth. You messed up. You tried going into that far left progressive socialist lane. Bernie owns it. Lock, stock, and barrel. Why would somebody want a copy of Bernie Sanders when you can have the original? He's there. He has his troops. He has his grassroots effort. He ain't going away. And right now, he has the votes. And if he continues with his momentum through Nevada, through South Carolina, and most importantly, through Super Tuesday, it's going to be Bernie's race. It's going to be his. And the only person that might be able to keep up with him is Michael Bloomberg, because Bloomberg has the money. And the short attention span in this country, and the question again remains, how many people paid attention to this debate? People might not even know that Elizabeth Warren struck those blows on Bloomberg. And even some people might say, who cares? Donald Trump did it. Why do I care what this guy did? We got to get rid of Trump. Okay? So those are some of the things that hang in the balance. Interestingly, also on the stage, you had Pete Buttigieg starting to attack Amy Klobuchar. Why? Because he understands that Klobuchar and himself are going after those same middle-of-the-road Midwestern value voters. So they're in the same lane too. So there's only enough room for one of them. It's either going to be Mayor Pete or it's going to be Senator Klobuchar. I think they both held their own. They both had their statements. I think Klobuchar probably got a little bit of the better of it, but she was clearly irritated. He did get under her skin, so I don't know how many people would have picked up on that. Again, how many people paid attention. But she clearly has momentum gathering in her race. But again, Buttigieg actually placed first and second when it comes to the recent caucus in Iowa and the primary in New Hampshire. So there's, you know, a lot taking place here. These people are desperate. They understand that these campaigns now are about getting the votes. And just as importantly, is having the money to continue. So that's why this is basically starting to whittle down between a race between Bernie Sanders, who has the votes and the grassroots support, and Bloomberg, who has the money. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic to see how this thing continues to play out. Will this turn into some sort of brokered convention? That's months down the road, but it's going to be very, very interesting. The policies that a lot of these candidates are talking about are completely ridiculous. They don't know what they're talking about. They are so anti-capitalistic, it's not even funny. And, you know, I mean, I'm going to try to give Bloomberg a little bit of credit when it came to some of the topics of climate change and his business record. When he was able to answer questions on those topics, he was fluid, he was rather somewhat articulate, and he had some statements down and he knew what he wanted to say. But when it came to what Elizabeth Warren attacked him on and some of the other candidates, he was flat-footed. So is he ready for prime time? Because Donald Trump will attack him and everybody else under the sun. It's not going to be a question about policy because Donald Trump cannot talk about policy. If you're honest with yourself, Donald Trump cannot talk about policy. He doesn't. He talks about little topics. He talks about how you feel about certain people or certain things. He talks about some statistics that he can pat himself on the back on. That's it. It's emotional. That's what it is with Donald Trump. He cannot talk about policy. And this isn't just me going after him because I don't care for him anymore. You can follow, and I've mentioned this to this audience before, a PBS Frontline documentary that talks about Donald Trump and Barack Obama. And then there are some further interviews of the people that they interviewed in full. So they talked to Steve Bannon, for example. Now, of course, on the documentary, they only edited in, you know, maybe 10, 15 minutes of Steve Bannon's comments. But they actually interviewed Steve Bannon for an hour or two. Well, you can actually find that interview. And if you go in and you listen to that interview and other interviews from people who worked for Donald Trump in the campaign and or in the White House, they're upfront with you. They don't have an animus towards Donald Trump. They tell you flat out, he doesn't read, he has a very weak attention span, and he doesn't have a command of policy. He doesn't. But he runs off of instinct, he runs off of being a mass communicator, and that's it. He doesn't have a one-year strategy, he doesn't have a two-year strategy. He has what's in front of me today, that's it, we'll deal with the next problem tomorrow. That's why it's so chaotic, that's why it's tweet to tweet, minute by minute, because there is no long-term strategy at the helm. It's what's in front of me today, who do I got to see tomorrow, and that's it. Because one of the interesting things that I thought was when one of the communications personnel who was interviewed in this interview, and I'm trying to remember his name, Clint Sims or something like that, he states how, you know, early on they wanted to get Donald Trump on a strict routine. You know, be in the Oval Office at 7 o'clock in the morning, go through ABC interviews and meetings and all of these other types of things, and we're just going to continue to move you along through your day. Well, he wasn't having any of that. Maybe it lasted for a short order, but there was none of that. And I said, well, that wasn't going to take place. So Donald Trump, he pretty much stays up in the residency until 10, 11 o'clock. He's dressed. He might be making some phone calls, but he's probably watching the news and he's tweeting, which we know because we see the timestamps and we know what he's tweeting about. A lot of times it's things that he's witnessing on TV at that time. So clearly he's not working if he's watching TV. So he's up there. He doesn't come down to the Oval Office till 10, 11 in the morning. And then he goes and does his meetings and other phone calls and that type of stuff. So that's what the man's doing. And again, this is coming from people who support the president, have no animus against him. They're just saying what the day-to-day is. All right? So that's what we're up against here. We're up against a party on the Democrat side who has terrible ideas that should not even be considered in this country, a lot of them. People don't understand what socialism is, which is unbelievable. But then when you understand who's running the K through 12 system, it's incredibly easy to understand why that is. And then you have a president of the United States who has no command of policy, is calling, we have trillion-dollar deficits, we got a trade war, we got farm bailouts, we do not have the greatest economy ever, and he's calling for negative interest rates. What a choice. What a choice. Ain't you proud to be an American? Please like, share, subscribe, get the word out, leave your comments. We do love hearing from you. Stay diversified, stay vigilant, and stay with the Capital News. I am Alex Kritis. Godspeed.